It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off. From tweets to Facebook, smartphones to 24-hour news cycles, we are awash in information. Research shows that today we absorb 5 times as much data every day as we did 30 years ago. That's the equivalent of reading 174 newspapers a day, cover to cover. And while data drives our information age, it leaves us staggering with information overload. So how do we navigate the deluge of information that comes at us every day and avoid becoming anxious and scatterbrained as a result? With us now is Daniel Levitin, neuroscientist and dean of arts and humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So I think most of us have a rough idea about how to, say, organize our sock drawer, but how do we organize our mind?
Well, I think part of the idea is to think about all the different things we have to do. And there are dozens of things we could talk about, but one is rather obvious, and that is to prioritize. Don't do first thing in the day the things that are least important, because you may find at the end of the day you haven't done the things that are most important.
I want to zoom in on what's actually happening in our brains as we try to process all this information. What happens during the day as we both pay attention to tasks that we hope to complete that are a priority and, you know, things that are humming along in the background? What's going on inside the skull?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are two principal modes of the brain's attentional system. One is, we're familiar with both of them. One of them is that we are engaged in a task, we're paying close attention, we're not distracted, and neuroscientists call this the task positive network. It's when we're engaged in a task. And this alternates throughout the day with another mode called the task negative network. When you're not actually working on something, your mind is wandering instead. And it turns out these form a kind of a yin-yang of your attentional set, and they're both necessary. If through an act of will, through deliberate willpower, we try to stay engaged in a task all day long, or a series of tasks, and never give our brain a chance to go to that other mode, we find ourselves fatigued and depleted, because it's that daydreaming mode that is restorative.
So sort of like, you know, regular dreaming is supposed to reset us a little bit too. Daydreaming, unhooking from the harness a little bit, can help too.
Right. And one of the ways that unhooking from that harness can help is that the daydreaming mode is often the source of our greatest insights into problem solving. So you can think about this logically. If you're working on a problem and you're unable to solve it, and you keep trying and you feel like you're hitting your head against the wall and you disengage from it, as soon as the daydreaming mode takes it on, the daydreaming mode is very good at finding connections among things that we didn't see were connected before. And the solutions to many problems require that kind of thinking as opposed to the linear logical thinking of the task positive network.
Now, you also write about something called the attentional filter. How does that aspect of the brain work?
In addition to these two modes, there is a filter running almost all the time in the background that's paying attention or scanning the environment for anything that might be urgent or important. Evolutionarily speaking, this might be the sound of an approaching lion, the sound of an approaching mate, any kind of a predator or enemy. And as you've noticed probably, whether you're daydreaming or whether you're engaged in a task, certain things capture your attention. You know, the proverbial shiny objects that attract a baby's attention. For us, it can be a sudden loud sound, which captures us and directs our attention towards that. This is a third component of the attentional system.
So given all that, how much harder is it today to process information in the so-called information age than it was 20, 30 years ago?
Well, as you said in the introduction, there's so much more information coming in. The average American watches 5 hours of television a day. That's a lot of images and a lot of dialogue. As you said, we're reading the equivalent of 174 newspapers every day. We're taking in either through reading or listening and encountering different factoids in the environment. So so it's very, very difficult to, it's more information than we can process, very difficult to keep up. So one of the things we can do is take breaks, make more time during the day to clear our minds and effectively hit the neural reset button.
So what kind of breaks are you talking about? I mean, a lot of us have demanding jobs where it could be hard to step away for a while and just say, you tell your boss, I'm taking a brain break. They may not buy it. There's so much work on the table. What does it take to reset the brain in one of these breaks?
Well, so we can take a lesson from air traffic controllers. I think we can agree that this is a very high stress, very high tension job, right? Where they've got a lot of things going on, there's lots of information coming at them, and if their attention lags for even a minute, the consequences can be disastrous. And it's no coincidence that air traffic controllers, by regulation, are only allowed to work 45 to 60 minutes at a stretch, and then they have to take a 15 to 30-minute break. And it's been shown in many, many research studies that these kinds of breaks are restorative to the brain, to efficiency. They increase your effective IQ, and they reduce accidents. Now, even though you and I don't have jobs where there's so much at stake, as an air traffic controller does, the same principle applies. So if you're sitting in your office with your legs, your feet on the desk, looking out the window, and your boss comes by, you could point to the dozens of studies I cite in the book about how in a variety of environments, based on carefully controlled experiments, people are more productive at the end of the day if they've been able to take those breaks than if they were forced to plow on through.
Can you tell us about a couple of those studies?
Well, so in one study, workers are made to work the way they have always worked. In other studies, workers are allowed to take naps, for example, even just one 10 or 15-minute nap in the middle of the day, whenever they want. And at the end of the day, the two groups' work output is compared, and the ones who took the naps not only did more work, but the quality of the work was better.
So taking a little nap would be fantastic. Not exactly workplace culture, but it does get at this idea that, resetting your brain with one of these little breaks could really help. But what about, let's say you take your break, you grab your smartphone, and you're checking your texts, and you're flipping through Facebook. Does that count?
Yeah, that's not a break. That's more of the same overstimulation and over-distraction. The most effective breaks, Veronica, are if you can take a walk in nature, if you so happen to be working in a place where you can step outside and there's trees or a body of water, any natural kind of landscape, or just to look at a picture of nature, or to listen to music, not the kind of rousing music that makes you want to exercise, but kind of music that makes your mind wander. Or, as I say, naps, other activities that help, or meditation. And all of this is proven to work. And you're talking about corporate culture. At least in California, a number of companies are setting up a culture of being able to take these breaks and naps. Safeway Stores, big grocery chain, has done this. Google and Minerva Schools at KGI, the new undergraduate program as part of the Claremont Consortium, has a nap room.
Wow.
And I use it often.
Can you force yourself into going into one of these daydream mode breaks? What happens if you can't get your mind out of that rut where it's just ruminating about work?
Yeah, that's a problem. So many of us in this over-caffeinated and highly driven time, when we turn away from work, we feel like we can't relax. We feel like if we're not working all the time, we're falling behind. Part of the problem is that, so many of us now, when we're at work, we're thinking about being at home. When we're at home, we're thinking about being at work. And so we're really in neither place. The key, what I'm talking about with the organized mind, isn't turning all of us into a bunch of Mr. Spocks from Star Trek. Not turning us into a bunch of automatons that are, robotic and completely focused. What I'm talking about is adopting a kind of habit of mind of working your best when you're at work, so that at the end of the day, the end of the workday, you can leave it behind you and then make more time in your life for spontaneity, for leisure, for fun, and for the relationships that are important to you.
And another thing that you recommend is sort of compartmentalizing, especially at work. Looking at your email all at once is one example. What are some other things that we can do?
Well, so the big problem is that for most of us at work, and I think this applies across a broad spectrum of jobs that people have, it probably doesn't apply so much to taxi drivers or publicists or air traffic controllers, as we mentioned, but most of us in our jobs, to do them well, we need to sustain some concentration for a period of time. And if we're constantly being distracted by that ping of email or texting or tweets, there's Instagram, Facebook news feeds, Vine, Pinterest, Tumblr, all of that breaks your concentration, and it means that you're less efficient and less able to do quality work. You asked a moment ago, how do you get into this daydreaming mode, or how do you disengage? Part of it is comes with, I guess I would say, adopting a mindset or a practice of making these partitions that you mentioned, Veronica. So if you do your email just in two blocks during the day, you set aside a time for it, you're not being interrupted by that constant ping of a new message. Same with social networking. Set up a special time when you do it. Now, in your particular job, that may not be possible. A journalist or a publicist, your job description requires that you're engaged at every minute. You're probably following six or eight feeds at once, right?
Yep. That's pretty much true.
And so in jobs like that, I think you have to talk to your boss about, and I hope your boss is listening, talk to your boss about adopting the air traffic controller model. There's another job where people do this and breaks are required. One of the most stressful jobs there is being a simultaneous translator at the UN. Because if you get one word wrong, it could mean a war. So you're taking in the information in one language, you're spitting it out in another, you're trying to watch body language. And those workers aren't allowed to work more than an hour to stretch either.
Interesting. Well, lots of different models to consider. Well, we're going to continue talking about this with our guest, Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we'd love to hear from you on this. How do you cope with information overload? Do you simply switch off your devices? Do you have other coping techniques that you share? And do you believe in the value of a nap? Of a daydream? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking right now about coping with information overload with Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we'd be happy to hear from you now. Do you have questions about how all of this works, how to incorporate it into your daily life, as apparently all of us read the equivalent of 174 newspapers cover to cover a day? That's the kind of information we're dealing with. Do you feel fatigued because of that? Do you think there could be a better way? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. And Daniel, you talked to some fascinating people as you were writing this book, and one of them was former Secretary of State George Shultz. What did he have to tell you about organizing the mind?
He had been president of Bechtel Corporation in the 1980s, and he's a very organized, clear thinker. And I learned a lot from him and a fellow board member, Edmund Littlefield, about how they can be efficient and still have plenty of leisure time. And it had to do with taking notes on little 3x5 cards. Their to-do list would tend to be written on cards. And they could shuffle them or sort them throughout the day as the priorities changed. And this is now recognized by neuroscientists as a very foundational principle of trying to be organized in your mind and in your life, and that is get things out of your head whenever you can and put them out there in the world, because the conscious mind can really only attend to a handful of things at a time. If you put it out on paper or you have some reminders out there in the world, it frees up your mind to be more effective.
So,
he said something else about military intervention. I didn't know if you were referring to that.
Well, that's interesting as well, yeah.
Well, he told me last summer something that I found really surprising and wonderful, actually. Reflecting on 40 years of United States foreign policy around the world, he said if he had it all to do over again, you remember he was Secretary of State, not to mention Secretary of the Treasury, if he had it all to do over again, instead of spending so much American money on bombs and weaponry, especially in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, he would have started in the 1970s building schools and hospitals so that the citizens there would love Americans rather than hate them.
That's a really interesting point. And we're going to go now to our phone lines, and John is with us from Houstonsford. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is that I am a maintenance electrician, and we often find ourselves in stressful, high-pressure situations. And at my work, we work 10.5-hour days, and our lunchtime comes, and we eat our lunchtime. I try to finish the crossword puzzle or the crypto quip, and at 15 minutes past the hour, I just shut my eyes, take a little short nap during lunch hour, and I found that it is absolutely the key to getting through the rest of a 10.5-hour day. It really does work, and it's true, and I 100% agree that if you can shut your eyes for a second and just turn yourself off, it reenervates you.
Oh, well, thank you so much,
John,
for calling.
John, it gets easier with practice, right? It might have been hard the first few times, but then you ease into it.
Oh, absolutely. It gets easier with practice, and to be quite honest with you, it's very common for our coworkers to stop in if their lunchtime is a little bit different, and it throws you off balance because you didn't get to just shut your eyes and put your feet up for a second, and it kind of throws you off balance. So pretty much everybody who comes in there knows that, you know, we're going to shut our eyes for 15 minutes and just leave us alone. And it works out, and I absolutely agree with your thinking.
All right. Well, thank you, John. John is someone who's put that to the test, and I think it's something a lot of us consider, but it's hard to actually try. But it's interesting to hear from John there about actually doing it and getting results. And Daniel, I want to ask you about education. What does all this have to say about the way that we practice education in America? Should we be doing things differently to help kids organize themselves and organize their brains?
Well, we should. I devote a chapter to this in the book because one of the consequences of the information age and information overload is that things are changing so rapidly that it no longer makes sense to try and teach the compendium of facts that we used to teach school children because facts are changing. What we know about genetics, for example, has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. If you had taken a class in it 20 years ago, half of what you learned is no longer taught. So our mission as educators and as parents has to shift from trying to cram a bunch of facts into the heads of kids into teaching them to be critical thinkers. This is exactly what we're doing at Minerva at the undergraduate level, is teaching critical thinking skills, habits of mind for being good consumers of information, to be able to know how to use information effectively and creatively to help solve the world's problems.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about that? How do you do that? How do you teach someone to be a critical thinker?
Well, we've identified over 140 different aspects of critical thinking. And each class, we teach those. We teach content, too, like history and calculus and physics. But the emphasis is on how to use these critical thinking skills. I'll give you an example. Critical thinking involves information literacy. If you hear a report, what you should do automatically, what any educated person should do automatically, is think to themselves, what is the source of this information? Is it a valid source? What's the evidence for the assertion? How do we know that the person telling us hasn't adulterated it? Could the person have any biases that might make them want to report something in one way rather than another?
Okay, so you look right at the facts and you try to analyze them then and there, and you're working, I guess, what does that do in the brain?
Well, it keeps the brain active in a critical mode. Critical, of course, doesn't always mean being negative. but it means wanting to have evidence for the things that you're asked to believe. And this helps people to become more confident in their own abilities, especially children. It builds self-confidence. It builds a kind of independence of thought that really is the foundation of a free society. The idea behind a free electorate and an informed electorate is that we're able to handle the information that we're given and use that information to make decisions about how we want to be governed.
Daniel, appreciate you joining us today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.